Esto es Cuentos del Confinamiento, o debo decir, era Cuentos del Confinamiento, y yo soy vuestro anfitrión, José. Como sabéis, ha pasado bastante tiempo desde la última vez que publicamos un podcast. Ha habido un tiempo del dique seco, un tiempo de hacer otras cosas y de recuperarnos de muchas cosas. Lucas, que es el coautor de los primeros Cuentos del Confinamiento, acordaos, donde contábamos las historias de Finia, la sirena, y de Sinbad el marino, y del megalodón, ese ser gigantesco que vivía en las profundidades. Pues nuestro amigo Lucas no puede acompañarnos hoy, pero seguramente lo hará en el futuro. Quería anunciaros que ha habido un cambio importante, y este es, para empezar, que retomamos la actividad en Cuentos del Confinamiento y que a partir de ahora Cuentos del Confinamiento tendrá un nombre en inglés que habéis visto, parece un poco raro, y sonaría algo así como Real Kickers. Y esto es así porque con nosotros va a trabajar una amiga que se llama Shelly y que es profesora de infantil, tiene una preciosa sección, un canal en YouTube de cuentos para niños, cuentos animados, que se llaman Whimsical Words of Wisdom, y que os animo a todos a que lo vayáis a escuchar. En la siguiente sección vamos a entrevistar a Shelly Hughes, para que nos cuente un poco de su vida y las razones que le han movido a dedicarse a esto de los cuentos de los niños y del por qué, qué hay detrás de todo eso y por qué es importante hacer cuentos para niños y dedicarles tiempo creativo que hoy en día, todos sabemos, es tan difícil de conseguir, ¿verdad? Pues eso lo veremos en la entrevista seguidamente. Para terminar, hay una última sección en la que Shelly, en su preciosa voz y su extraordinaria técnica de vocalización, por algo ella es profesora, narra un cuento que se titula El primer ser humano. Esa es la última sección, ya veréis que os va a encantar. Nuestra idea, como comentamos en la entrevista, es que el podcast a partir de ahora sea en dos idiomas, en español y en inglés. Nos hemos dado cuenta que es muy importante mantener el conocimiento de los idiomas a un nivel alto. ¿Y qué mejor que escuchar cuentos en ambos idiomas, verdad? Así que esa es una de las razones importantes por las cuales vamos a retomar este podcast. Y porque el objetivo de crear un mejor futuro para nuestros hijos y chavales está siempre presente. Simplemente deciros que hay otra razón también, y es que hemos visto que la mayor parte de los oyentes del podcast no son de España, que es el país desde donde emitimos, sino de otras partes del mundo. Hay muchísimos de América, en particular solo tantos oyentes de Estados Unidos como de España, por ejemplo, lo cual nos ha sorprendido muchísimo. También hay de Europa, de Oceanía, de África y de todas las partes del mundo. Así que os mandamos a todos un cordial saludo y un fuerte abrazo. Espero que os guste y os dejo ya con la entrevista a Shelly Hughes.
Hello.
Hello, Shelly.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. This is amazing. How exciting. I'm so glad that you're here. Because this is Real Kickers with Shelly. Please, I'd love to, to know also, and for the benefit of the listeners of the podcast, a little bit more about your background and why you become interested in, you know, in sharing stories with children or aimed to help children overcome difficulties, regain confidence, and so on. I'd love to listen some your story.
Mm-hmm. So to be honest, I've been like a primary school teacher for over 11 years. And although I always had the same approach. It was only recently when I was living in Dubai, in the last few years, that I transitioned to more a specialist role. So I was focusing more on the creative arts. So art, drama, dance, music. And I kind of took like an early years approach because like the acceleration and the passion and the excitement and the love for learning that the younger generation like show. I just noticed that as it goes up the school, they kind of lose that magic. And I get, you know, first year of school, they're a bit anxious at first, and then, you know, they're exploring and they're learning and they love it. And I know some schools do adopt this approach, but generally, I was actually speaking to my auntie about this earlier. It's kind of like they get to year one, not so much, but year two, definitely. And then it's right, maths, science, art. Everything is very in a box. And the thing is, life isn't in a box. Like right now, like you go outside and you just look around. Before you know it, you're you know, estimating, very mathematical mind. You're looking at the design that's very artistic. You might be exploring the colors and the vocabulary and reading the signs. And yes, I get, like, as you get, you know, you move up the school and you get older, that, you know, there are things that you just have to, as they like to say, sit down and learn. But my approach, even though, you know, I was predominantly, for most of my teaching, say, 30 young children in one class and only that 30 each year. But then I had like access to over 400 as a specialist from like, I don't know, from 4-year-old right until like 10, 11-year-olds. And honestly, I didn't change my approach because actually I realized that the approach worked for all children because I introduced the topic, I give them the power to take control over the topic, and then, you know, they generate the outcome. And so, for example, say like dancing. So when we think of dancing, not saying it's more aimed at girls, but there's kind of a little bit of a stigma of, you know, girls generally maybe are more expressive and take to it a little bit more.
Yes.
And so when I started, I did have like boys like, I don't like it, this is stupid. But by the end of it, these boys were expressing themselves. Now, does that mean that I put them into a box and say, oh, well done, you've ticked off dance? No, because the outcome isn't about them being the most magnificent dancer in the world. The main teaching that I felt was that a child who did not want to have a go, had a very fixed mindset, was disinterested, is now standing up confidently expressing themselves. So if my success as a teacher is to get all children to do exactly the same, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, just saying it, it's boring. Yes, in life as a dancer, you have to learn routines. But actually, where is the freedom? Where's the self-expression? And this is the thing. These boys who had, you know, they wouldn't even speak out in front of a group are now showing their dance moves. And I have their parents saying, I don't know what you've done to him, but he's putting on the music in the morning and I can't stop him playing this song. He's like, he's just constantly dancing.
Wow.
So this is the thing, like, so you can say, you know, maybe you were lucky. What, with 400 children, I was lucky? Because I had children, they were so passionate about art, so passionate about drama, dance. And I don't think it's because I'm an outstanding teacher. I think it's because I gave them the freedom to express themselves. I didn't say like in art, right, everybody sit down. We're going to do this frog and it has to look exactly like this. No. How do you want to do it? What do you want your frog to look like? What emotion are you going to give your frog? And this is the thing. When a child takes ownership and there's a purpose and a meaning behind what they're learning, then they get develop that passion. It's like with everything we do. You know, a builder, for example, if a builder was just told, no, keep putting that brick there, put the next brick on, put the next brick on, and they had no idea what the purpose of it was, how on are they going to have that, you know, that passion, excitement, like to know that you potentially are building something for a loving family to live in, or, you know, a hotel for people to go and stay in and relax. It gives you that drive and that purpose. And I think, I'm not saying all schools, but I think that's what's missing. Is we tell children a lot, do this, but they don't understand why. Like, why do I need to learn maths? Well, do you know what? When you're older, you could have this job, or you could, you know, you can learn how to multiply your money, or you can, it just needs to go back a little bit to real life. Like, why? Why are they learning it? And that's just what I've always done throughout my whole teaching. I as much as possible, I try and link it to real life. And so, yeah.
Well, it sounds amazing and very enticing. I have to say that it rings a bell, because so you're saying then doing things is important, of course, because we need to have things done to get things done, like, you know, houses and everything. But we humans are not machines. So it means in the end that for us humans, the purpose, the why is important. So it's so, and that really is simple, but it's profound. Because I think that we normally forget, right? When we are working at a company, or when we are doing whatever the task we are doing for a company, given company or organization, whatever. So if we don't have, you know, the like the engine in us burning with fire, so we are not going to be propelled forward enough to finish the task or to accomplish something, whatever. We are only gonna do that if we really have a why, and that is something that is a beautiful learning.
I think also though, yeah, the why, but also like it's the execution of it as well. So for example, you'll see in early years, say children, you place the, going back to the building scenario, you place the bricks, okay, and then they start building and they say, this is a house for my cat or something, yeah? So yeah, as much as, yeah, reward the child, but so for example, like, that's amazing, but rather than that, because then that child will build the same again each day, because they receive the praise and they love the praise. But yeah, in a way, like, each time as an educator, you have to give them a little bit more. So for example, I would praise them and then I'd say, oh, Teddy doesn't have a home. Like, I purposely pick a scenario where the house now is too small, because then I want them to see if they can modify and, you know, change their approach. So for example, I'll give them a humongous Teddy and say, oh, but Teddy wants to visit the cat. How's he going to fit in? And they'll giggle, but then they'll make a house exactly the size of the Teddy. And I'll say, but how is he going to lie down and go to sleep? So each time now the child is having that higher level of thinking. But I'm not saying it's wrong and I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying I'm asking questions, but how? And then through that, they want to achieve the outcome. So each time you'll see that you just leave them. Because this is the other thing. I think sometimes we tell kids the answer too soon. They need to think for themselves. They need to actually gain the skills to sometimes be put a little bit in, like, not discomfort, but be like, I don't know. And I have this with my children all the time when I first start teaching. You know, they'll like the artwork. I've had children tear it up and kick a chair or throw it in the bin. But by the end of that year, or by the end of that 3 months, not even a year sometimes, that child is sitting and having a go. So someone walking in might not see a finished product, but that for that child to sit and keep persevering and going, that's the thing that these inspectors don't understand, is they don't see the development. They see, oh, that child's not finished their work. Yeah, but you don't know the progress of that child. You don't know where that child came from. That mm-hmm. child wasn't sitting at the start of the year and was throwing chairs. Now that child is sitting there, engaged in their learning and having a go and not giving up. And that this is the thing that all these, you know, inspections of teachers and checking that everything's done. Well, I'm sorry, not every human being is in one box. Not all of us are supposed to finish the race at the same time. So that's kind of why I had to step a little bit out of education, because I just felt in my soul that I wasn't aligned with this pushing these children to the finish line. Like, they're all different, so we should celebrate their differences.
Okay, Shelley, I think this is this has been an amazing first podcast, Real Kickers with Shelley, and I'd love if you can, you know, say the last words for the episode, something that has that you have learned in dealing with children at school that has really struck you or surprised you, and that you didn't expect to learn that from a child, for example.
I think the biggest thing that I often say to a lot of people, because, you know, we have those typical talks of, oh, good luck with that class when they come up. You know, like, you have these like stigmas around certain groups of children. And I think before any teaching starts every single year, you have to just get to know those children, and they just have to know that they're safe in that environment and they feel loved and they can speak. Because we can all start straight away learning, teaching. Oh, why is this child not doing that? But the foundation is actually putting them foremost as a human, a little person that, you know, one morning they might have lost their favorite teddy, so they're not in the mood right now to learn numbers. Numbers are not important to them right now. You know, like, sometimes we just need to step back and think, okay, what can I do right now to make this child feel more comfortable in this setting? And I think this is the thing, is we have this pressure of, right, we only have this long for maths, this long for English. Everyone from the get-go, it's run. And if you're with that stamina, and children pick up on energy, yeah, it's just like, stop, breathe. Yeah. And, you know, I started doing that. I wouldn't say like I was doing a meditation, because, you know, like, everyone has their rights to do whatever they want to do. But just even taking 3 deep breaths before we start, because, you know, they run through the door. You don't know if they've just had what they've just eaten for breakfast or for break time. And they're, hey, miss, hi. That, you know, you can't speak to a child that's that high energy. You have to just bring them down. All right, are we all ready? Let's go. And I think that's what we need to start doing, is just stop, breathe, let's go.
I love it.
There's too much. Go, 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 go.
I love it, Shelley, definitely. Stop, breathe, let's go. I love it.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, with those words, I think that is the perfect ending for this podcast session. And I really enjoyed talking with you.
Y hasta aquí la entrevista con Shelly Hughes. Espero que os haya gustado. A mí me ha encantado hablar con ella. Os dejo con el cuento El primer ser humano, The First Human Being.
Resiliency tales for children and other creatures. Storytelling to boost hope in uncertain times. What is a species, and how does it explain that we are all a big family? When we were taught biology or natural sciences, we learned that there are different species out there in nature, which explains why a certain animal or plant is the way it is. We are also taught that there is one key distinction which defines different species, which is why they don't interbreed amongst one another. Cats can have kittens, horses can give birth to baby fowls, and people can have children, for instance. Species is then an idea, a tool if you like, that we use to separate and define, or more technically, classify animals, plants, fungi or bacteria as belonging to a certain closed, exclusive group. But when we think of what actually happens in nature, are the boundaries always narrow and clearly drawn between them? On the contrary, more often than not, we find them to be rather blurred. Take us, Homo sapiens, for instance. Homo sapiens, I hear you asking, what on earth is that? Well, let me explain. That is the funny name we use for ourselves as species people, and it literally means wise men. But why should we have funny names like that one instead of just people, you might ask? Well, that's easy peasy, because the word for species, like people, cats, horses, ants, etc., is the word we use in every different language. So some clever scientists some time ago thought, if we use a special name for each species, can we then be sure about what species we are dealing with when we are, us, scientists, are talking about our stuff? And sure thing, they invented scientific names. So getting back to our Homo sapiens business. When we take into consideration that there is just an unbroken line from one generation of people to the next, or in other words, from parents to offspring, without big differences from the dad or the mum to their children, then we start to understand how it works, right? Take my son Lucas, for example. He looks very similar to me and his mum, with only tiny differences. Equally, my wife and I look very alike to our respective parents, and so on and so forth, since the dawn of time. The key here is to keep the tiny differences, as you will see later. Hence why I explained earlier that there is an unbroken line dating back to our ancestors. By the way, if you didn't know already, the previous species gave birth to ours. Homo sapiens was previously referred to as, now this is a very long word, Homo heidelbergensis, because that's where the bones of a man from Heidelberg, a town in Germany, was found. So how and when can we actually draw the line between us and the previous species that gave birth to us? Okay, now that we know everything we need to, let's try and see if we can figure out precisely the right moment our species began. Are you ready to go on a magical tour and peer into the ancient past? This is the true story of the first human being. A long, long time ago, say roughly 10,000 generations, which is not that much if you think of it, Mum, a protagonist was feeding her second child, sitting on a bench made of wood and animal fur, watching the red, glorious sunset depicting the beautiful summer's evening. Second, so they called her second child, was already eight, but he had begun playing with a beehive all day long, and the bees got very angry at him. So they stung him a lot, even in his throat, so he could hardly eat. Mum made him a puree and began to feed him. When suddenly, Mum was startled by a realization that everything had shifted. She had an intense feeling that something was radically different than it was just a breath ago. She had a strong insight and immediately called her third son to her side. "Bud," so they called her third son. "Listen, I've got something to tell you," Mum muttered with a little nervous voice. "Yes, Mum," said Third with suspicion. "I'm sorry, but you don't belong to our species anymore," she said with sorrow. "But Mum, why is it always me? Why not Second or Third?" "I'm sorry, Third, but we have to split up the species somewhere, I suppose." "But I don't want to, Mum. I want to stay with you," said Third stubbornly, with his arms crossed in front of his chest. All right, we can keep doing things together, I guess. But our species is now Homo hybernus, and yours is different. It's Homo sapiens." But Third could not understand. And you know why? Because he was no different from his siblings, first, second, or even his cousins for that matter. They all had blue eyes, long brown curled hair, dark skin, and a happy, smart grin lined with yellow teeth. He was equally as strong and almost as tall as his brothers. But remember what we said at the beginning of the story. In reality, there is no big difference from generation to the following, only tiny differences. It's these tiny differences that over a long period of time become big differences. And it's then when the differences are big enough that we call them a new species. So getting back to Mum, at that precise moment, the conversation changed as Mum got back to her senses and she expressed, brushing her hair away from her face with her hand, as if waking up from a strange dream. "You know what, Third?" "What is it, Mum?" "I love you, and if someone in the future thinks you're a different species to us, then I don't care, because I love you anyway." "Okay, Mum," said Third, with a sigh of relief. "I love you so much too." And so, one day, 250,000 years ago, we discovered the tiny bone of Third's little finger, also known as a pinky, when digging up the soil to build a house somewhere in Africa. The discoverer may have remarked at the time, "This one is like us. He must have been the first of all our species, Homo sapiens." But we know the real story, right?
Y eso es todo, amigos. Aquí acaba el primer episodio de la nueva temporada de The Real Kickers with Shelley.